I watch a lot of movies, or at least I like to. And when I can watch a movie, I'm pretty much interested in the action sort of plot. Every once in a while, my wife and I will watch a chick flick, and so the action is different. So there were, in movies and in stories, you and I are both familiar with these ideas of plot and themes. Plot being the step-by-step action, but the theme being the underlying belief or the underlying moral of the story or the underlying current of energy that is driving people or the conclusion that people will arrive at. So this morning, I want to talk about the main negative themes in people's lives. I think that most of us could look at our lives and compare the action steps in it. You know, we get up in the morning, we wash up, we go to the bathroom, we eat, we go to work, and we come home, and those things, and we can pretty much create a list of action steps that are common to our culture. If we were little children, we would recognize that we would weave school into that, we would weave play into those action steps. But the underlying negative themes, I think, could be pretty much characterized for us, and maybe these are more universal than the actions that we would take individually. A lot of people are struggling with survival issues around the world, while in our culture, it's more comfort and convenience struggles going on, if you will. So I wanted to address what I think are a list of, not comprehensive or not complete by any means, of the main negative themes that we could be experiencing in our lives. And these would essentially start very early on. And the first one that comes to mind is the idea that underlying all of our actions could be this belief or theme that we are not wanted. We weren't wanted, and we're still not wanted. If we've arrived at that conclusion early, maybe because of the type of conception of our physical body or what we learned in utero or at birth or in the early years, that idea of not being wanted is a very common theme for a lot of people. The acceptance of that as being true then changes a lot of our actions. We will think differently. We will feel differently about ourselves and others. We will use different words to ourselves or to others about ourselves and about others. And we're going to take different actions because of that. And so you can imagine that for a person to come in with the belief that they were not wanted and are not wanted now, their ability to belong, their ability to connect, their ability to interact is going to be more limited than the person who has real beliefs in their ability to do that if they were wanted in the first place or they felt that they were wanted. Really, this is all about our individual perceptions. Whether we were wanted or not is one thing. How we felt about it is really the key to it. And you can imagine that while we could have been wanted as an individual or a baby, oh, I want to have a loving baby. But then when the mother or the father or other people start to consider the ramifications of having a baby, the consequences, and what that means that they have to go through from a plot standpoint, the action steps that they inevitably are going to have to take, then there could have been some reluctance, some ambivalence about it. And really, it wasn't about us not being wanted. It was other people going, you know, this is going to be inconvenient. It's going to be physically difficult. It's going to be financially difficult. It's going to be emotionally difficult. And they're thinking really about the consequences of a baby. They're not thinking about the baby. They weren't really thinking about us individually. They were thinking about the demands being placed upon them and, based upon their interpretations, might have decided that they weren't up to it emotionally, physically, financially. Then now their hesitance, their reluctance, their regret or they're not wanting pregnancy makes a lot more sense. But if we interpreted that as meaning we were not wanted, that theme, that underlying belief would need to be healed. Were we wanted by our parents? Perhaps, perhaps not. Were all children wanted by their parents? No, they weren't. But if we were to look at that and say, were we wanted? Well, wait a minute. Was I wanted? Well, by whom? By the neighbor down the street? Probably not. Never gave it any thought. By my parents? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It seems they focused on that. But if, as an expression of divine consciousness, and divine consciousness wanted to give birth to me, wanted me to express, wanted me to be an offshoot or a piece of divine consciousness, then I could say, yes, yes, from divine consciousness's point of view, I was wanted. From human consciousness points of view, well, that depends on the human consciousness and the individual with that consciousness, how they were feeling about themselves, their capabilities to provide, to love, to do the things that they wanted to do, what was in their own self-interest. But if we've got this underlying belief that we weren't wanted, we're going to want to heal that and expand that idea of it's our relationship with divine consciousness is the one that really makes the most sense. It's the most constant. It goes from before conception to after our death. Everything else is transitory in comparison to that relationship. There's a book written by a psychiatrist, Dr. S is her first initial, Modi, M-O-D-I. The book is called Remarkable Healings. And she used hypnosis dealing with psychiatric problems with her clients. And it seems to be a frequent theme in there where she is trying to help them heal from outside influences, that oftentimes there is a belief or an expression of an idea that that being did not want to be born, did not want to be born into this family, did not want to have a physical life because of perhaps the perception that life was going to be difficult, life was going to be difficult in that family, and what the future held on a physical level was very unattractive at that moment, just prior to birth. So that idea of not wanting to be born is a different theme, if you will, that you can say, okay, it seems to me that that is more likely to be a human consciousness belief that has arisen now, maybe coming from the physicality that this being is now experiencing, cellular memories from past generations and also picking up energy from father and mother at this point. You would say, wanting to be born, wanting to come into physical form, had to have been decided, according to my beliefs, by the being in order for them to be born. So we would have decided, okay, I need to be born, I want to continue my spiritual growth, which is what I believe is the purpose of life. I want to continue my spiritual growth. But then when these details start to become perceptible, this family, this is going to be difficult, this is going to be challenging, this is going to be my body, do over, I don't want to do this. It's a very common experience for a lot of people to say, if I knew how difficult a circumstance or a situation or an activity or a project was going to be, I wouldn't have ever started on it. Some people say that about business, some people say that about military careers, some people say that about having a child or becoming a parent and raising a child, and on and on and on. If I knew how difficult it was going to be, I wouldn't have ever started on it. But the fact of the matter is, the people who typically make that kind of a statement are people who have successfully navigated through all the plots of that particular activity. They've taken the action, they bumped into walls, they had struggles, they had pain, and have come out the other end going, wow, wow, if I knew all these details beforehand, I wouldn't have done it. That's probably true of us in a lot of different cases. It would be nice to take the easy road all the time to our goal, but the fact is, we don't always perceive that. And maybe it's true, we perceive it only rarely. If we looked at being born as a decision that we made in concert with divine consciousness, we would have decided at that point, because I'm aligned with divine consciousness and I want to spiritually grow, I want to be born. I'm okay with being born into physicality. When we start, maybe near birth or shortly thereafter, to recognize the difficulties that are going to be involved in our physicality, we may now listen to physicality and not listen to spirituality. We may be listening to the struggles that are inherent in physical memories, generational memories, and we stop listening to the source of our being. We stop listening to the idea that we are always going to be connected to divine consciousness. So the support that we had when we made the decision to be born is going to be available to us up to and including time after our physical death. So at no time are we going to be disconnected. But we lose sight of that because I'm guessing the impingement of memories start to become so staticky, so loud, then we start to become more aligned with our human consciousness that's connected to our physical individuality and our ego, that now we stop listening to the spirit and start listening to the body and get frightened. I think we can heal this, because if we don't heal it, it's almost as if we're going through life with a foot on a brake. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. And if you have that underlying, I don't want to be here, I don't want to do this, you can almost imagine the resistance that comes with that, the rejection that comes with that. So instead of flowing easily and elegantly in the accomplishment of our goals, we're mostly resisting by having our foot on the brake. One part of us is trying to hold back while the other part wants to go forth and express and to grow. Real important to heal that if we hear ourselves expressing this. And this is how it would show up in a life. You would hear that kind of resistance. You would be in opposition to a lot of different things. You would hear it in your self-talk. You would hear it in speaking to others. You would be able to hear it in the way you judge things. I don't want, I don't want, I don't like, that sort of thing. So if you hear a lot of that, you've got a clue now as to what you would want to heal. Another theme occurred to me the other day, and it's this one. Something bad is going to happen to me. This comes from a lot of different directions, I suppose, but one of them would be the idea that as a way to protect ourselves, it's almost a survival instinct to consider the landscape looking for threats. What could go wrong? What could go wrong? Let me plan my strategies accordingly so I can avoid the consequences of death or other painful experiences, either physically or emotionally or mentally. So we seek to perceive these threats, something bad, as a way to avoid them. But as we magnetize ourselves to this, if that's what our filtering is and that's what our focus is, we now start to draw the something bad to us. Culturally, we get trained in it too. Pretty much everybody has heard this experience, when it's verbalized to you this way. Don't get so excited about how good things are, because bad things are going to happen. Some people have a kind of a two-sided coin there. if something good is going to happen to me, something bad is going to happen to me shortly thereafter. So now you just go, I can't have good without the bad. That belief can be healed, and it needs to be healed. You can imagine this cliche might be devoted to that idea. You know, the devil that I know versus the devil that I don't know. How to make a choice about voting for somebody or choosing a particular course of action, for instance. It's the thing that we're familiar with. It's like, well, I know how painful this is, but plan B, I have no idea how painful that's going to be or whether it's going to be painful at all. But the suspense, the uncertainty about it is so difficult to handle, I'll settle for plan A, which is a level of pain that I've become familiar with and which I, to some degree, have learned how to tolerate. That can be healed. Something bad happening to us is a reflection of what I believe to be the true idea, the law of cause and effect. We reap what we sow. If that's true, as Christ says in Christ Returns, reveal startling truth, that the law of cause and effect is one of the gifts being provided by divine consciousness for all of its creations all the time. It's how we can make our lives predictable, happier, healthier, more successful, more fun. Because if we want more happiness, more health, more success, more fun, all we have to do is sow the seeds to that. We sow seeds by our thinking, our feeling, our speaking, and our actions. So, if we want more happiness, guess what? Our thoughts, feelings, words, and actions need to be aligned with happiness. We need to be creating or facilitating or causing happiness in other people's lives as well as our own lives. And if we do that, the effect is very predictable. Nobody goes out, no farmer anywhere in the world, goes, plants corn, and ends up with tomatoes. That's not what happened. If they're sowing the seeds of corn, corn is what the result is going to be. That's what the harvest is going to be. When it comes time for the reaping, there is really no surprise that corn is going to grow out of those actions, out of the seeds that were planted earlier by that farmer. I take the point of view that unforgiveness is a huge challenge in our lives, individually. And in fact, if I could only talk about one subject with clients, only one, I would be talking about our tendency not to forgive ourselves. Self-rejection, that is, disapproval of ourselves, refusal to forgive ourselves for something we did or didn't do, something we thought, something we said, something we felt, something we did or didn't do, is really what fragments us as individuals. It breaks our individuality into pieces, and it interferes with us performing effectively in life. It makes health, happiness, success, and fun much more difficult when there are multiples of us, the one we like and the ones we don't like. That self-rejection for something that we did bad that impacted other people is the primary reason for self-rejection, in my opinion. My belief is like this, that even at a very, very young age, even pre-verbal, a child can interpret the unhappiness in their environment, mommy being unhappy, daddy being unhappy, siblings being unhappy, as their responsibility, as their fault. And as a result of the child, the infant, not being able to make other people be happy, the child thinks something is wrong with them. That aspect of the child that is wrong, that is bad, that is defective, is not loved, is not wanted, and the child starts to fragment. They don't like the part of them that didn't know the right thing to do. I believe that this impacts a huge number of people, more than it doesn't. So if you would think back that a child can go, wow, my parents are unhappy, they're having an argument, they're doing this, it must be because I didn't do something, I'm not enough, I don't know what to do, so on and so forth. I can make the case for that being that the child, the body is small, it's an infant's body, for instance, but the spirit that occupies it is not small and has historically known what life in the spirit world is like and goes, wow, I know what love is, I know what harmony is, I know what a true connection to divine consciousness is, and here I am in an environment where that is clearly not happening, and I can't make it happen for one reason or another. I don't know what to do, and I don't like myself because of that failing. Obviously, it's not a failing on our part that our parents are unhappy or emotionally processing things in an effort to cause themselves and others to be unhappy. It's really a function of the consciousnesses of our parents that has resulted in their being unhappy with one another and primarily with themselves. Their own individual self-rejection erupts into a projection onto the other parent, onto other people. And it is that underlying, they should have done something. Frankly, I think what is a common problem in this scenario is that the parents feel bad about themselves for not being able to do all the right things for their infant. How to make the infant warm, how to make the infant stop crying, how to make the infant happy, how to make, right? And the parents have now, what's wrong with me? You know, I ought to be able to make a little teeny baby happy, and I can't even do that. What's wrong with me? And so now, they are all staticky and start erupting. Their self-rejection projects outward onto other people, and even onto the baby. So if we've got these feelings about the unhappiness in our family of origin, that can be and needs to be healed. In the book Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth, Christ talks about the human consciousness having these experiences as a result of being born into physical form. The sense of abandonment, loss of security, and loss of privacy. Now, it's pretty easy to imagine that a baby who, for approximately 9 months, was contained within the mother in a very predictable, in a confined space, intimately connected, umbilical cord, etc., and then in the roughness of childbirth and the severing of the umbilical cord and the pulling away of the baby by the attending people, nurses and so on, and gets cleaned up before it's given back to its mother. That shock of separation is really overpowering for an enormous number of people. In a couple of books that I'm reading, one is The Secret Life of the Unborn Child, and the other is Welcoming Consciousness, talking about prenatal and birth experiences and how they impact a child. When that child is taken from its mother immediately upon birth and the severance of the umbilical cord, all kinds of disharmony sets in, not only for the baby, but for the mother too. And they've done scientific studies that show that the babies who are immediately placed on the mother's chest and given to her is beneficial to the mother's ability to produce milk, the mother's ability to connect to the child, the activation of maternal instincts, and all kinds of wonderful things hormonally in the mother's body. And you can imagine that a baby for 9 months has every single moment of the time has been hearing that heartbeat, and now all of a sudden there is no heartbeat. It's like uh-oh. But to be given immediately to the mother upon birth, laid on the chest, and guess what? Ba-bum-ba-bum, is available. It's like, okay. Alright, so this is not so different than where I've been for the last 9 months. Children who are treated that way, immediately given to the mother, and mothers who immediately have access to their children, have a whole different relationship with life and one another. That baby is more secure, gains weight faster, is healthier, processes information more effectively, is more aware, more alert, and will grow to be more intelligent. You'd go, wow. So that sense of abandonment, that sense of disconnection, that sense of being cut off from the source of its life, just imagine now, the source of life, of course, is divine consciousness or God, right? But then for 9 months, the source of life has been the mother's body, and so this withdrawal, this disconnection, this severance of that connection is mighty upsetting. One thing I learned years ago from our puppy, her birthday is actually September 25th, it was 11 years ago, is that when you have a puppy, you want to put a puppy into a small cage so they can feel the effects of security from a small, confined space. So if you think of the space that the puppy experienced prior to birth, and you could do the same thing with a child, you could imagine, that's relatively small. That confined space creates a sense of well-being, a sense of security. When that is diminished, and it's diminished at birth by taking a baby from a small, confined space and putting it into a very, very large world, a small, confined, dark space into a very non-confined, very large, very bright, very noisy space. And you would go, no surprise that insecurity is a result of so many, quotes, normal childbirths in Western culture. No recognition of what the child had been experiencing and what they're experiencing now. Pretty much everything is done for the convenience of the medical staff, with a little bit of consideration, or lip service anyway, to the safety of the child and the mother. But if they thought about the mental and emotional safety of the child and the mother, things would be different. That feeling of insecurity, of being, lost in space, if you will, not comfortable in environments, having a tendency to be timid about going into different places, different geographical locations, you might want to take a look at that. That can be healed, and it needs to be healed. The world needs to be your space, your environment, and becoming at peace with it and becoming secure in it would really do wonders for your health, your happiness, and your success. Now, that doesn't mean going into any environment. You wouldn't go inside the cage of a lion at a zoo, nor would you go into a place that is noticeably dangerous. You wouldn't go where gangs fight and battle, and you wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't want to go to war zones and stand up in the middle of a firefight. But you do want to be secure about normal places. When we're born, not only are we coming into physical form for our own individuation, But we're coming into an environment that our presence will impact. We're going to change the environment into which we're born. If we're the only child of two parents, our arrival changes their lives dramatically. We will be a relatively constant demand for attention, demand for their energy, demand for their time, demand for physical action. And I recognize that some people are better at handling that, are more mature, or more committed, more responsible, more able to focus, have more attention and intention to deliver to us versus other people. If we're not the firstborn, our arrival now is changing the dynamic of a family. If there are other people already born, we have siblings that are older than us, our arrival is going to change their lives dramatically. If we're the second born, now all of a sudden, because of the need for care that we have, we're going to take attention away from the older child. We will be a threat to their attention. And frankly, this is a pretty common perception that the newest child arriving is, in fact, a saber-toothed tiger to the other children who already are in that family, because the attention gets divided up again. They get pushed off center stage, being the star of the show, in terms of what their needs are. Now, the infant, the newest one, has greater needs that have to be attended to. And the older child or children are pretty much going to be reduced in the care that they get, and they're going to be left on their own to a greater extent. Not all children welcome that new person, welcome that saber-toothed tiger, welcome the person who is going to take their attention away from them. And if we recognize that that has happened to us, where we weren't welcomed, we were not wanted by them because they perceived they were going to lose something. It was in their self-interest to not have us around. If that's their perception, then we have to recognize that any animosity that they displayed to us was not really devoted to us as an individual. It's not because of who we were. It's the fact that we were. It was our existence was perceived as a threat. And under threat, human beings do one of two things primarily, and that is fight the threat or run away from the threat. So to hear an older child say of a younger child, you know, "Mommy, get rid of him. We don't need him. He's not necessary. You love me more, right? We don't need him. Why do we have him? Give him away." You go, "Wow, wow." Those conversations actually do take place. The older child is not noticing this is an opportunity for friendship and love and having a playmate and having somebody to take care of and nurture and support, but in fact, seeing it as somebody who is their enemy. If we've had experiences like that, it can be healed and it needs to be healed, because that kind of feeling can be projected into work environments or into friendships or even into family relationships of our own when we grow up and are married or have children. Then it's like, this losing out because of somebody else and that we're not being wanted and we don't want them. So if we've got older child beliefs about that, if that theme is running through our activities, or we have the younger child themes running through our activities, that needs to be healed. Sometimes you can see this in work environments when somebody new joins a group, a sales group, or some team project group in a company. People can welcome that person, see them as an asset. whose strengths are going to benefit the group, but other people see it as a threat. That new person is a threat, and they can be really unkind and cruel to them and exclusionary. And you go, wow, what's up with that? I would say what's up with that is they had these experiences early on, and they were never healed. Being born into a family, or noticing that there are other children, is going to give us an opportunity to develop another negative theme. That is, when we compare ourselves to what other people are capable of, particularly a younger child comparing themselves to an older child, they notice, you know what? That older child is much more capable than I am. Something is wrong with me. I am not fill in the blank enough. I'm not this enough, that enough, smart enough, tall enough, rich enough, old enough, strong enough, pretty enough, handsome enough, good enough, and on and on and on. As a means to explain to themselves why the older child is able to do things that they're not able to do. The idea that physical maturity, 2 or 3 year head start, for instance, is the main factor, doesn't occur to an infant or a small child. They just recognize that that child is more capable and we're less capable. And they use that as a theme, that becomes their rule, that becomes a programming statement, becomes a belief that now can impact their lives from that moment on. They dial down their own capabilities because they misunderstood the difference between somebody else's capabilities being based upon age and maturity and experience, and not because of worthiness or intelligence or inherent goodness. That not enoughness is a very, very big deal. And it's this not enoughness that gives rise to that self-rejection that I was talking about earlier. We don't like ourselves when we're not enough. And when we reject that part of us, we just further degrade our capabilities. If we didn't compare ourselves and in fact used the other person as a role model, their capabilities is like, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do when I grow up. That's what I want to be like. Which is really the image that is far healthier for us, to be able to see what's possible and not use the image as a way to denigrate ourselves. So if we can use that to see what's possible, now all of a sudden we're using it to inspire ourselves. If we can turn around and use our experiences to inspire ourselves, we would have come a long way to creating health and happiness and success instead of resisting our experiences. More about this in a future Sunday talk. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.